I want to start with a question. What's your impulse control like? Are you one of those disciplined people who never deviates from the plan? Because I'm not. Not at all. Sometimes that's great, sometimes not so much. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we've got a lot of stories about impulses, from the well-known concept of the impulse buy to the creative and social media impulses of Kanye West, to what happens when a country depends, maybe a little impulsively, on one industry. We're going to take you to Venezuela to hear about the effects of the oil crash there. Come share your thoughts with us, deliberate or impulsive or whatever. Go to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting with the stuff we buy, and not the careful, planned out, budgeted things that were in last week's show. This week, I want you to mentally wander by a cash register and pick up whatever thing it is your impulses tell you to reach for. We asked for your most memorable impulse purchases, and wow. We are starting with Carrie Peterson, who lives in Rochester, New York, and an impulse purchase named Sebastian.
I bought a 1.5-pound, 9-week-old Chihuahua puppy for $600.
That is quite an impulse purchase.
Especially considering that I was living in a rented house where I was not supposed to have a dog, and my roommates had specifically told me not to bring home a dog. And I did exactly the opposite. So the next day, I realized, oh my God, I bought a dog that I had no business buying. And I called the store to ask if I took returns. They did not. And ultimately, I had the dog for 16 and a half years, and he was a great dog. It turned out to be a great impulse buy. He passed away in November. So
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you.
And so you had, like, the moment of regret, but then after that, what happened?
Well, I dealt with it. And it turned out to be great. He was a wonderful companion, but it was not a wise decision at the time.
Carrie Peterson, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Micah Berman in Durham, North Carolina, has an impulse buy story that happened in a state that everyone can probably relate to. Heartbreak.
Growing up, my whole life, I pretty much wanted a motorcycle, but it was one of those things where I figured, you know, I'd eventually get one, but there was never any pressing reason to get one. And then I was in a semi-serious relationship. She dumped me, and then, like you do, you decide that you want to take the 3-day motorcycle class, and then the very next day, I bought basically a brand new motorcycle.
Wow. What was going through your mind?
Actually, it was kind of back and forth. I had I spent a couple weeks in the whole depression stage, and then I was honestly just kind of I had signed up for some email notifications from a local dealership, and so they advertised this motorcycle class, and it kind of just clicked. I was like, oh my gosh, this is now the perfect time to do this. I talked to my brother because I was kind of on the fence about it, and he said that if I didn't do it now, I'd regret it. So it was a little bit kind of whirlwind. I had to take out a loan. I'd never taken out an auto loan before, but I kind of had blinders on in that moment and just decided to go for it.
And I gather you still ride it.
I do. Anytime that it's pretty, North Carolina is kind of a rainy state, but it also has plenty of sunshine. So anytime it's sunny outside, I'm on it.
And Lynn Burkett, also in North Carolina, clocks in with the biggest impulse purchase on our show.
My impulse purchase was a house.
Oh, my God.
And it was our first home. My husband and I were walking down the street in the village where we lived in northern New York. We had lived there for 3 years, and it was a nice spring day, which is a big deal after a long winter in northern New York. And there were lots of older Victorian homes, and they were just so cute. And we hadn't been thinking about buying a house at that moment. And there was one that just caught our eye. It was a yellow house. There were flowers lining the driveway. There were window boxes with flowers. It was just, it had cute written all over it. And it just seemed right. And I think that was a Tuesday. And by Friday, we had an offer accepted on the house.
That's amazing.
We didn't look at any other homes. It was just right. And we had never, it was our first house. We loved it.
Next week, it's a leap year. So in that vein, we want your stories about leaps. Maybe you were talking about leaps of faith, or maybe something you couldn't control, like getting fired. What happened after? Or you leapt from the mailroom to the top of the company, or suddenly came into some money. How did you get from one place to the other, and what did you learn? Tell us about that journey. Go to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. By now, you probably know the terms long and short, but here's a quick refresher. Long for betting on something, like a stock, short for betting against it. We do that here with news stories, topics and trends that our guests are positive and negative about. This week, we're keeping it all in the Marketplace family with our correspondents Kimberly Adams and Andy Euler. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
All right, Andy, this is your first long and short
the
segment.
Inaugural.
So I'm going to let you, yeah, your inaugural. I'm going to let you go first. What are you long?
So I'm long on Brazil, which might sound
really
crazy. I know. So Brazil is in a bad spot, and I get that. Their currency, the real, has dropped almost a third in the last 12 months. You know, there has been all sorts of scandal.
They're in massive recession.
That's exactly right. The worst in more than a century. But I think these scandals, and I think just having Brazil on the radar is actually a good thing. And I think what it's going to do is it's going to make Brazilian authorities and Brazilian prosecutors and things like that move more.
Hate to rain on the loving Brazilian sambaing
sure
parade, but I was wondering how Zika maybe plays into this.
Yeah.
There's that
that's
whole
fair
mosquito-borne illness that's causing havoc and freaking out a lot of the Olympians. And you know, there was also a lot of reporting this week that Brazil's not even close to ready for the Olympics, and there's problems with the water that's supposed to be used in the swimming competitions. I mean, give me a little bit of hope.
Sure. It was tough. It's especially tough for ethnic minorities and also people that don't have a lot of money in Brazil. But what I think is going to happen, what I think may happen, is these events and things like this are going to put a spotlight on that. And I think you're right. I think Zika is going to be an issue. But I think what's happening is it's going to lead to improved Brazilian status or Brazilian people having a better life.
Okay, Kimberly, you're up. Give me your long.
Okay, my long is relatively inexpensive internet in the developing world. Now, I know this is going to sound a little bit crazy because Facebook recently got the boot in India for its Free Basics program. But let's keep in mind, Free Basics still operates in about a dozen other countries, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, and there are even more programs sort of in the pipeline to provide internet in the developing world for little or no cost. So, for example, there's a company called Jhana that just raised $57 million to bring unrestricted internet access to different parts of the world. And so I see this as something that's really actually going to happen eventually in some way.
You both have like the counterintuitive longs, but I guess I will accept it. Okay, Andy, let's pivot to your short. I cringe at the incoming mail we might receive for this, but go ahead. Give me your short.
I know. My short is Kanye West. And I'm to blame for part of this. I'm complaining about how much we're talking about Kanye West, and of course I bring him
and
up.
And here you are talking about Kanye West. Yeah.
Call me out for it. And I also totally sound like a dad. I'm not that old. But I'm just tired of hearing about it. You know, it's not like I'm tired of hearing about people in economic situations. But I'm just tired of hearing about Kanye being in $53 million of debt after your kids have furs on and you have a sweet Nike deal. And also just
your wife is raking it in.
Exactly. It's hard for me to have any kind of sympathy.
I saw a really interesting story that, you know, Kanye is roughly double the amount of debt that he makes. And that's just like everyone else in America in terms of this debt that
right
so many of us carry. And that said,
it's just
you know,
on a bigger scale.
I was gonna, well, and it's also
just
not student
on
loans
a bigger scale. Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, if you can sort of decipher or translate Kanye's, you know, you could read those tweets to him as him saying that it's not his personal debt that he's talking about, but his various failed business ventures that aren't doing so well.
Kanye's now, ideas.
Yeah. But the other part of that is Kanye is doing kind of exactly what he needs to do. He's drawing attention
sure.
to himself. We are talking about him right now on a business and economy
show. On a business economic show.
Right.
Exactly. Whatever you want to say about his music or, you know, whether or not he needs some assistance in his life, he is generating buzz, and celebrities need to do that to keep themselves making money to maybe pull themselves out of their epic debt.
Absolutely. All right. Take it away with your short then, Ms. Adams.
I am, unfortunately, as the D.C. reporter, short on the American political process as it pertains to the U.S. Constitution. Guess why, guys?
The president shall nominate.
That's fair.
Well, both very good guesses, the election and the fact that the Constitution requires the president to nominate justices for the Supreme Court. And we've recently had the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. Therefore, one would guess that the U.S. president is supposed to nominate his replacement. But that looks like the process for that is going to be quite fraught, especially in election year, with many of the Senate Republicans whose job it is to confirm said nominee or deny it, saying that they don't even want the president to nominate a replacement. And this is just sort of the latest example of our system being a little bit, I won't say broken, but let's just say it could use a tune-up.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Marketplace's Andy Euler, thank you to you both.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you, Lizzie.
There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace shows so much, because numbers are a huge part of the economic and financial world. And every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them on Marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with this week's news by the numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
358 million.
That's how many Chinese consumers paid for something with their phones last year.
To put that into perspective, 319 million people live in the U.S., by the way.
That's a market Apple's trying to break into with the launch of Apple Pay in China this week.
Unfortunately, they might be a little late to the party. Two companies, Alibaba and Tencent, already have about 90% of the market there.
88.
That's how many years it's been since a U.S. president visited Cuba.
Here's a fun fact for you, Tony. 30th President Calvin Coolidge was the last one to visit the country.
Okay, nerd. President Obama heads there in March as part of a drive to normalize economic relations.
The Commerce Department approved $4.3 billion in investments into the country last year.
500,000.
Torrent Freak says that's how many people downloaded Kanye West's new album, The Life of Pablo, illegally.
And that was just in the first 3 days.
The rollout behind West's seventh album has been unconventional. As of this recording, it's not actually for sale, and Yeezy says he's still tinkering with it.
Yeah, but when a Samsung partnership can make Rihanna's new album go platinum, do you actually need a traditional release anymore?
True enough.
Over the past few weeks, we've been talking about oil a lot, because the world is in the middle of a massive crash in oil prices. There's just too much oil out there. We are oversupplied. And that makes things very rough in places that rely on oil for their revenue, like the country of Venezuela. Venezuela is in talks with other oil producers to try to halt some production and maybe stabilize oil prices. But on the ground there, things are rough. Marketplace's Scott Tong is in Caracas looking at what this means there. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Lizzie. How are you?
I'm good. What does it look like and feel like there? You've been out reporting. Paint a picture for us.
Well, okay, I've run into a few things. One of the things I've run into is inflation here. Numerically, the IMF is predicting, there's a bird going off. Numerically, the IMF is predicting inflation is going to be 700% this year, but here's how it feels on the streets of Caracas. So I had this hot dog thing called a pepito, where it's a hot dog buried under like 10 things. It's a heart attack on a big roll. It's awesome. I asked the guy what they charge for this a little bit ago, and he said the price has gone up by about 15 times in the last 5 years. So that kind of gives you an idea of how fast prices of everything are going up now. If you shop for a microwave, the price can double in 2 months or so. It's a long story of hyperinflation, but you feel that when you're walking around Caracas. The other thing is, it's not what you pay for things, it's whether you can find them in the first place. I was in the barrios, the slums, yesterday, and you enter and you see lines. You see people lining up outside the state-owned shops for basic consumer goods because there's a shortage of everything. You may have read about this. There's a shortage of meat, toilet paper, milk, birth control pills, condoms, acetaminophen, regular life stuff, cornmeal. Yeah. And this is how you shop for it. You go in line based on your ID. So if your ID ends in 0 or 1, you get to shop on Monday. If your ID ends in 2, you get to shop on Tuesday. So you get your day to shop, and you have to stand in line. And after you wait for 40, 50, 80 people to shop, you see what the store might have left because the shelves are very often empty. There was a truck we saw go by in the slum that we were in, and people... 100 people raced to when the truck stopped at a stoplight to see what was inside, right? Maybe they were going to load it into a store and they can get in line and buy the toilet paper they needed. It went up the hills, you know, the slums are up in the hills, and the truck turned out to be empty, didn't have anything. So everyone kind of trudged back into their space in line. That's life. That's a day here in for the poor in Caracas.
What about the price of gas?
It's an alternative kind of math universe, as you can hear. We were in a small sedan, and we filled up for 3 bolivars. And at the official exchange rate is for importing the most necessary things to Venezuela, medicine, food. Most people don't get that. But at the official exchange rate that they tell the world, that's about 50 cents for a full tank, 15 gallons. At the unofficial, which is the real exchange rate everybody has to pay, which is instead of 6 to 1, it's 800 to 1 or 1,000 to 1, you basically move the decimal 3 places to the left. So instead of 50 cents,
wow,
it's 0.05 cents to fill a tank of gas.
Scott, you've been talking about, obviously, the dependence of the Venezuelan economy on oil. The country sits on huge reserves. How do people feel about oil now and their national relationship to it?
Venezuela sits on the world's largest mountain of oil. It has more reserves, more proven reserves than the Saudis, than anybody, than Iran, Iraq, the U.S., Canada, anybody on the planet. They've got the most here. And yet they pump about a third of what the leading producers pump here, the Russians, the Saudis, even the U.S. Their production is down. That's a long story. But the way people think about the relationship with oil is... it's this paradoxical relationship. People of a certain age grew up to believe they were privileged. That is, when the price of oil was at 100, was really high, and the revenue was coming in, it was rolling in, people were living well. They got jobs, they could buy imported things, and they saw themselves as a wealthy people because they had a wealthy resource. And yet economists talk about a resource curse. One of the oil ministers many years ago here in Venezuela said oil can be a gift from God or the excrement of the devil. It is a boom-bust place, and people have that relationship with oil too. But the curse part is that as much as Americans are addicted to using oil, they're as addicted or more to the revenue from the oil.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Caracas for us. Scott, thank you so much.
Sure, you're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
As Scott wandered around Caracas, he found something cheerful in the middle of all of this. Music. A lot of it. Here's a little of what he found. Let's stay in South America right now. We are going to go from Venezuela to Chile. With cold nights and hot days, Chile's got some of the best conditions for growing wine in all of Latin America. And Chilean wine has gotten increasingly popular in the last few years, here in the U.S., in Europe, and in China. But now there's a new trend. A small number of vineyards are starting to produce organic wine made without pesticides, weed killers, or synthetic yeast. The BBC's Jane Chambers has this story.
Santiago by night and the Vino Tinto is flowing at the Bocanares wine bar. Many of their customers love to drink the organic wine made by Viña Emiliana. And earlier on today, I went to meet their chief winemaker, Noelia Orts, at Los Robles Vineyard, which is 2.5 hours down south from Santiago.
We're in your truck. It's quite a bumpy road. Yeah. Really, really beautiful vineyards all around us. Where are we going now?
Now we are going to one of the highest parts because I want you to be very close to the native forest. It's a tool to work organic. First, because it gives us organic matter naturally. Imagine all the leaves when they fall down and then with the rains, they go into the vineyard. And the most important thing is the biodiversity.
We've got rows and rows of vines in front of us.
Here you have Carmener, the most Chilean grape variety.
And what does Carmener taste like? What makes it so special?
The aromas. In good Carmeners, you can get dry leaves. Sometimes you get some chocolate, you can get also, that I like, some hints of mint or wet earth. After a rain, if you come to this vineyard and your smell reminds me to Carmener.
Back in traffic-filled, noisy Santiago, I'm off to see Patricio Parra from Wines of Chile. I want to know who's buying Chilean organic wine.
Well, the main clients definitely is European Union, United States, Canada. We export to more than 150 countries, I think, but probably United States is the first one.
One of your biggest buyers is China. What's happening with them? Is there a worry that with the economic slowdown, things are going to be difficult with them as a market?
Actually, we have an office there and trying to spread the message of Wines of Chile in terms of the most premium, sustainable and diverse wine in the world. Sincerely speaking, you never know what can happen with the wine consumption, but definitely in a country where the economy is not growing very well, probably it can affect the Chilean wine also.
Chilean organic wine is still very much a niche market. Patricio told me that many winemakers do it alongside other types of wine. In Chile, 3,500 hectares are certified as organic, and that represents 2.7% of land used for vineyards. Viña Emiliana was the first one to go completely organic back in 1997. Their head winemaker, Noelia, explained how they managed to keep weeds under control when they don't use weed killers.
In the flat areas, we work with horses, right? In other areas, much more difficult for the horses, we use machines. We cut the grass with machines. But in Chile, mostly of the rain comes in winter, and then we have a lot of weed in that moment, and because the soils are wet, you cannot go inside with machines. What we do is we have an agreement with a shipperman that during the spring and summer, he has his lambs in the Andes Mountains, but when the winter arrives, there is no grass, there is too cold, so he came down here into this vineyard with 600 sheep or lambs, and they cut the grass. We move the lambs from one block to another, and they do that job. They cut the grass, they give manure, imagine, and because they are lighter than a cow, for example, they don't compact the soil. So three benefits in one.
So lots of activity going on in front of us, clinking of bottles, people working.
We are bottling the wines from 2014. It's a mobile bottling plant, and for us it's a symptom of quality, because at the end everything happens in this place. We have the grapes, we vinify them here, we age the wine here, and then we bottle the wine here.
I'm in Bocanariz, which is a wine bar that specialises in Chilean wines. It's in the very touristy area of Las Darias. We've got lots and lots of people around us drinking wine, and I'm here with the head sommelier of the restaurant.
Lautaro Soto.
And what kind of people in this wine bar are asking to drink organic wine?
Well, the 80% of the people is from America, from Australia, and this kind of people like try this kind of wine. We have a lot of small producers. In this case, it's very important because these small producers make wine by hands, okay, and this is organic for me.
All this talk of wine is making me really thirsty, so I think it's about time that I ordered a glass for myself.
That story came to us from our partners at the BBC.
Music.
One of the things we do here is take stories that you suggest and dig into them a little bit. We call it local money. And this week's story comes from Ted Wang, who wrote us about a threat by the ride-sharing companies Uber and Lyft to pull out of Austin, Texas. They don't like the city's proposal to fingerprint drivers for background checks. It's just the latest in a series of political fights that ride-sharing companies have gotten into lately. Audrey McGlinchey is the City Hall reporter for KUT in Austin, and we called her up to learn more. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Can you back up and explain to me how all of this started?
Sure. Here in Austin, we're dealing with a new city council. And before that, their predecessors had set up what was intended to be a temporary set of regulations for Uber and Lyft. And these were pretty basic regulations. You know, it sets out basically that these drivers have to have background checks that are national in scope. It sets out things that these companies were already doing, but that the city wanted to codify. And the city council said to those folks who would come on after them that we want you to relook at this and, you know, decide if there are other, perhaps stricter regulations that we should put in place for these companies. And that's what the city council has tried to do.
Was the city council or were members of city government getting a large number of complaints about, say, sexual assaults or inappropriate behavior from drivers? Where did the fingerprint thing come in?
There's been one vocal council member, one of what are two conservative voices on the Austin City Council, since we are a liberal hub here in Texas. And he has brought up this fact of, why are we doing this? Why are we looking at this? We haven't heard anything from constituents. And that seems to be the general sentiment. But at the same time, the city council, other members have said, well, we were tasked, you know, the previous council wanted us to look at this again to make sure they had done their due diligence. And what they heard from city staff and state staff was that fingerprint-based background checks are the only way to ensure that the person who is applying to be a driver is indeed that person. And the taxi companies in Austin are required to get fingerprinted. And so one of the other arguments the city council has made is we're just trying to line up these two services so that there are the same requirements.
And after all, doesn't Uber operate under fairly strict fingerprint checks in Houston?
It does, yeah. Uber does. That is, according to them, the one city that they operate in that does require fingerprint-based background checks. Mm-hmm. And that has been a constant question from the Austin City Council is, you operate in Houston, why won't you do this here? And to be honest, Uber has not been able to provide an adequate answer to that question. They have basically just said, we do it in Houston. It doesn't work well in Houston, but we do it. We don't want to do it anywhere else. We don't want that to be a model in other cities.
This will go to a public referendum in May. What do people in Austin think about all of this?
So it will go to a public vote because Uber and Lyft funded a political action committee, a PAC here in Austin, that collected enough signatures, roughly 20,000 signatures, which then forced the city council to either accept these rules, basically written by Uber and Lyft, or put it to a public vote. Last week, they decided they would put it to a public vote. And there's a lot of arguments where it boils down to, well, Uber and Lyft have said they will leave if we require these background checks. You know, folks have said, I use this all the time. It's essential to me. So, you know, I will vote in a way that makes sure they do not leave. And then there are other people who say, and I think this tends to come from an older audience, but for example, the mayor has three daughters. He has said this often. I don't want my daughter to get into a car with someone who I'm not sure has been vetted as thoroughly as possible. And so it does seem to be kind of split along the lines of, I think, younger folks who use Uber and Lyft very often and rely on it. And then a more older generation who is kind of taken aback by the idea that you would get into a car with a stranger and that they may or may not have been background checked in a way that the city council says is the safest.
Uber and Lyft have put money behind this idea of defeating these rules. They've funded a PAC. How much are they investing in trying to get the rules they want?
Well, their PAC was formed just a few days before the new year. So they were really only required to file on that January 15th date how much money they had spent in that roughly 2 weeks. So it's hard to know at this point how much they've spent in total. But at that time, they revealed that between the two companies, they spent roughly $20,000 in monetary funds and then roughly $30,000 in non-monetary. So that's certainly a significant amount of money. And the city council has often brought up the precedent that this sets, that if the council tries to regulate any field of service, that we live in a world where, you know, a company, if it has the means, can fund a petition to set their own rules, basically. And that is something that has been very frightening to the city council. And they've said, you know, it is a scary precedent to set.
Audrey McGlinchey, who covers City Hall for KUT in Austin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Lizzie.
Come tell us about the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplace.org and click on Local Money. Do you remember the term Grexit? That was the idea that Greece might exit the European Union, hence the pun. Now there's a similar term bubbling up in the United Kingdom, the Brexit. That's the idea that the UK could leave the 28-country bloc. This week, there have been contentious meetings about the Brexit and migrant policy among European leaders. Britain has big differences with its European partners. And later this year, British citizens will get to vote on a referendum about whether to stay in or pull out of the EU. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has this story from the English city of Dover.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Not far from Dover's famous white cliffs, in a bitingly cold wind, an open-air service of remembrance is underway.
We gather here to worship God and to remember those who sacrificed their lives during Operation Fuller some 74 years ago.
Operation Fuller was an heroic but doomed mission off this coast during the Second World War. Six canvas-covered British biplanes took on the might of the German Navy and were shot to pieces. Today's remembrance, says local pub landlord David Little, is a timely reminder.
We had many hundreds of thousands of men who made the ultimate sacrifice in laying down their lives defending our country. They were defending our sovereignty.
And that, says Little, a former parliamentary candidate for the UK Independence Party, is what he and fellow opponents of EU membership are also trying to do.
We're not at the moment laying down our lives, but people like myself feel very strongly about self-determination, passing our own laws and being independent from the European Union.
But local supporters of the EU drew a very different moral from the Operation Fuller memorial service. Lawyer and member of the pro-European Liberal Democrat Party, Anthony Hook, says it underlines the EU's finest achievement.
What the European Union has done is to abolish war in Europe. We're now at a point where war in Europe is inconceivable and human rights are safeguarded all over Europe. And that's something we really need to protect.
A car ferry looms out of the fog in the English Channel. Dover is the busiest passenger port in the world. 16 million travellers pass through every year, and more than 2 million trucks. This city calls itself the gateway to Europe. But there are plenty of people here who want to slam the door shut on EU membership. Daphne Duggan and William Burgess fret about other European citizens having the right to come and settle in Britain.
How would you vote, in or out?
Out. Definitely. You have all these immigrants coming in. I have nothing against them. It's just that there's too many. We're only a small island.
Would you vote in or out?
I would vote out. It will bring power back to our government, hopefully.
To control the border?
Absolutely. It's too many people.
But others, like Terry Sutton, a local historian and a freeman of Dover, are more worried about the economic repercussions if Britain votes out.
I'm definitely going to vote staying in. It seems madness to think of coming out.
Madness? Why?
Dover does very well out of the European community. If we came out, they might put back tariffs and therefore there'd be less work for Dover Docks.
At his pub, the Dog Inn, landlord David Little claims that the EU wouldn't dare slap tariffs on British goods. The Brits import much more from continental Europe than they export there. The EU's unlikely to hamper cross-channel trade. It would be business as usual.
We absolutely love Europeans. We want them to come here and spend their money. We want to go there and buy their cheese and their wine and their food. We want to trade with them. What we don't want is unelected commissioners in Brussels passing our laws.
There'll be blue.
This wartime song helped turn the White Cliffs of Dover into a beacon of freedom and hope. There was no doubt what that meant in the dark days of World War II. But today, black and white shades into grey. Dover is divided, and both sides in the EU argument claim that freedom and hope are their aim. In Dover, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie. Man, it's kind of cold out here.
You think?
Let me ask you something. Does this particular, what's happening right now, you and me, the microphones, does all of this feel a little familiar?
It does. Gotta get back in time. So now we're at the payphone.
Yes.
Payphones, there
pay
are two.
Phones. Yep, one of them doesn't work.
So how many of these are there in the city, and what's the idea behind turning some of these into Wi-Fi hotspots? That was us a year and a half ago out talking about this same thing. What are we talking about today, Benjamin?
We are talking about Wi-Fi hotspots on New York City streets.
Back when we did this the first time, they were kind of theoretical. Now we're actually standing in front of this thing.
It's like a giant obelisk. It looks sort of like that thing that comes down among the monkeys in Space Odyssey 2001.
Okay.
Like almost.
It says, get ready for super fast free Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
What is this?
So Link NYC is New York City's program to convert old payphones throughout the city to free Wi-Fi hotspots with USB charging ports and a free Android tablet that you can look up directions on and get other sort of city services from. Original number, Lizzie, when we talked way back when, was about 10,000. It looks like this will eventually be available at about 7,500 payphones
in total.
Or former
payphones, we should
say.
Yeah,
former payphones. About 4,500 Wi-Fi stations will come about in the first 4 years here. The expected cost is $200 million, though Link NYC expects advertising to recoup the cost.
Always the advertising.
Yeah.
What's the deal there?
Okay, so ads on the kiosks themselves. Also, you know those incredibly annoying airport and airline Wi-Fi services where you have to like watch a minute-long ad before you log in?
And pay like $45,000 for 12 minutes of internet?
Yeah, so maybe get ready for that kind of thing as well. But also advertisements, of course, on the outside of the stations themselves, IRL, if you will.
If you will. But free. This stuff is free.
Yeah, it is free for us. And it's not actually an insanely new innovation in urban centers around the world. So Taipei has this. Taiwan's city of Taipei. Tel Aviv has this. Perth, Australia has this.
Okay, but the question that I'm curious about, is this safe, right? Every time you and I talk, I want to know, can I, you know, do my online banking on the Wi-Fi network? That seems not great.
And the answer is always no, Lizzie. You should have learned by now. The answer is always no. One of the things that we say about public Wi-Fi hotspots generally, whether you're in Starbucks or sitting on a busy street as we are right now, anything where you might actually log in to a service is something you want to do really carefully and probably avoid, especially when it comes to banking, social media, important accounts, email accounts, things like that, because
everything I use the internet for?
Yeah, basically everything you use the internet for. But if you're already logged in, it's less of a problem. Now, the way that a hacker would get in is they might use something that's called a keylogger, and they would have that working through the same Wi-Fi hotspot, and it would detect your device, and then it would log all of the keystrokes you input into your device, and then they would go through that information and find out maybe, oh, okay, you logged into a bank, this is your password, et cetera, et cetera. This is an interesting one as well. Only have your Wi-Fi on when you're using it. So, like, if a hacker created a public Wi-Fi network with the same name, your device might try to connect to that one instead of the one you actually want to use. So just be thoughtful about when you turn your Wi-Fi on and off on your device as you're walking around in the city.
Okay. Is this going to be decently fast? I mean, what do we know based on the other ones that are out there?
So the one that we're standing next to literally still has, like, the plastic wrap on it. I don't know if you can see the...
Yeah, let's
yeah,
just
don't
peel
you want to peel it off?
I do kind of want to peel it off. This is like the thing that comes on the front of the phone. Ooh.
It's so good to peel it off. I know. So this one is off, but there have been some tests done. And the answer basically is really fast.
Really?
The number is going to vary depending on how many people are on the same hub, but think maybe 10 times faster than your, you know, current public Wi-Fi in Starbucks, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be super fast.
This is happening in New York now. We mentioned other cities. Is this going to spread everywhere?
This is an interesting question, Lizzie. This is something that's already out in a lot of cities. People are experimenting with it. One other city that has this is the city of Paris. And you may remember that after the terrorist attacks there, there was legislation proposed that would actually block public Wi-Fi in the case of a national emergency or a local emergency, I guess, in that case. And the thinking there is that it can be really hard to identify a specific user who is on a public Wi-Fi hub. And so law enforcement is concerned about that aspect of using public Wi-Fi. And so there are some conversations around security that might be problematic for a city that's covered in public Wi-Fi. But at the same time, this does really feel like the way that everything is going. We want more connectivity than we ever have before, and we'll continue to want that as long as the internet exists. It's not a fad.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie. Let's go inside and get warm.
Okay. A week from now, a multi-billion dollar business is going to throw itself a party and hand out lots of awards. I'm talking about the Oscars, and so this week we're preparing you. Also, we want you to win your office pool. So I have one of the hosts of APM's culture show, The Dinner Party Download, with me, Brendan Francis Noonan. Welcome back.
Hi, Lizzie. Thanks for having me back. Excited to be here.
I realize that you're probably not going to come to my house to watch the Oscars, but I would like you to
That would require an invitation.
Yeah, I know. I would like you to walk us through how to throw a decent Oscar party, because this is something I feel like people aspire to and fail.
Yes.
How expensive does this have to be, first off?
This doesn't have to be expensive at all. I mean, basically, whenever you throw a party, our rule at the Dinner Party Download is everyone brings their own bottle of wine, a bottle of wine per person, even if they're a non-drinker, so you have an abundance of wine. You pretty much have to just provide a television. And you could even just do popcorn because it is the movies. You could act like it's just like, you know, you did that not because you were cheap, but because you wanted to pay tribute to the movie theater. Or you could go, you know, you could get it catered or you could do something a little more substantial. But, you know, you pretty much just need some booze, a television, and some snacks.
What sets a good Oscar party apart?
A good Oscar party, it's a lot like life, I think, Lizzie, where you have to take it simultaneously and not seriously enough. Right.
Okay.
This is the Oscars. On the one hand, this is one of the oldest awards ceremonies in the country, which is kind of amazing. It first started in 1929. It is now seen in more than 200 countries. It's this huge deal. Everyone can gather together and have an opinion on it. But on the other hand, these are overpaid people who don't even fully represent our country, which we've heard a lot about this year with the Oscars So White. So a lot of the fun is kind of making fun of the people. And the red carpet is a good time to do that. But I think you can kind of keep that mischievous spirit alive throughout the screening. And so I think here's a way you can do that.
Okay.
Two screens, okay?
Oh.
One is a TV for people who take it seriously. Or when you want to take a certain category seriously, you walk into that room. The other room is more the loose, fun, catching up room,
making fun of the
TV room. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the other rule, really. Like, you can't really take this too seriously. These are not the Human Rights Awards. These are our modern kind of I mean, this is awful. This gives me too much credit. But, you know, these are kind of like the Greek gods or Roman gods of yore, where we like to watch them mess up and make mistakes. And so it's okay to be goofy and mock them.
When you think about channeling your Schadenfreude, or maybe it's rooting for someone, you want there to be actual skin in the game. You believe betting is important.
Yes, I've come to believe this. So my co-host Rico Galliano is a very strong believer in betting pools. I resist it, but now I agree with him because you need something on the line when you get to that part of Oscar night where they're talking about the best sound mixing, the best animated short. You know, look, it's hard enough to even to see the main features. So to stay invested during those portions of the party, it's worth it to have money. Yeah,
money.
Money.
Okay.
You know that.
Yeah.
Can I bring up another tip?
Please.
Okay, because lest you think people should just be goofy and drunk, you know, the in memoriam section is the one part of the night where people need to be quiet and pay attention because these are people who've passed. And at some point, I guarantee it will induce goosebumps because even if it's you don't feel really close to one of the people who's passed away, you'll see a movie they worked on or something. And you'll, you know that feeling when you hear StoryCorps on public radio and you start crying in the shower? Wait, is that just me? That feeling could happen. And even if it doesn't happen for you, we need to be respectful.
Fair. I like that one. So all of this is taking place in maybe somebody's private house. And maybe they're not walking out or giving people, you know, several hundred thousand dollars of gifts, but the rich people at the Oscars are actually getting that?
Yeah. So you may have heard me scream in my office the other day because I saw this article on CNBC. It's entitled, "This is What is in the 2016 Oscar Swag Bag." It is crazy. The current bag is worth $220,000.
What?
That's up 30% from last year, where it was only worth $168,000 last year. And these are given often to the winners of awards.
They're giving, like, salaries, really good salaries.
It would be, you know, so you hear the number and it is crazy, right? But it's a little clickbaity because if you unpack it, you know, among the things are like three fitness training sessions with Jay Cardiello valued at $1,400. I don't know who that person – I mean, clearly, look at me. I don't know who that person is. So there's just a lot of stuff like that. Like, you know, you could get an all-access trip to Israel if you want to take it, that sort of thing. There's three complimentary nights at the Grand Hotel Tremezzo near Lake Como in Italy, right?
I'll take that.
I know. Here's one that – is actually pretty noble. It's a donation of 10,000 meals to an animal shelter or rescue of the nominee's choice.
That, I guess, is supposed to make us feel a little bit better about the free vacations?
Yeah, you're right. But, at least they're trying.
As you know, I'm a hyper-competitive person. If we're betting, how do I win my pool?
I mean, first of all, you need to go see the movies. Okay. So you have a week. Catch up.
Yep.
Maybe invite your nerdiest friend, someone who's seen all the documentaries and the short docs, right? And you kind of talk to them, pump them for information. And then what you also could do is if you're hosting the party is you could fill out 5 ballots. People are going to be drinking as the night progresses. And I'm basically saying you should cheat.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. Will you help me fill out my ballot?
I will help you fill out your ballot.
Brendan Francis Noonan, co-host of the Dinner Party Download. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Lizzie. I'll see you at your party.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, Samantha Bee takes the Marketplace quiz. And we'll hear your stories about economic leaps. Want to share yours? Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.